those capital budgets are usually dealt with by the end of the session, end of the regular session. So I've never known of this process before.
A look at how the state capital budget was finally passed. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, after a long repair effort, water service is restored for residents of New Stoyahawk.
We had to shut everybody off because those that had water weren't conserving it enough to let the tank fill up.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When the state legislature passed the capital budget last week, it ended a negotiating process that largely occurred behind closed doors. That's often the case for legislation that requires the Senate and the House to work out their differences. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on what lawmakers say about the process.
The Alaska House and Senate each passed different versions of the capital budget, funding roads and other infrastructure, this spring. But unlike in past years, they didn't form a conference committee to find common ground until the end of July. On July 27th, the legislature returned to Juneau for its third special session. In 5.5 hours, the two chambers met, formed a conference committee, and passed the $1.4 billion capital budget. That pace and closed process upset some members of the Republican House Minority Caucus. During the capital budget debate in the House, North Pole Representative Tammy Wilson said she had never seen anything like it.
We should be really concerned because it's a public process that we're giving up, the public process of being able to testify on what's in this budget.
It was unusual for lawmakers to meet on the capital budget outside of the legislative session. It's not unusual that they resolve budget differences behind closed doors. Budget conference committee members usually meet privately to work out details. When they hold public meetings, it's to vote on the compromises they've already reached. On the 27th, the committee unveiled the new capital budget. In 29 minutes, the committee shot down some House Minority Republican amendments and moved the bill along. Eagle River Republican Senator Anna McKinnon had the gavel.
And technical changes.
Are there objections? Hearing no objection, the conference committee substitute will be forwarded to each body. Members, please stay behind to sign the report. With that, we're adjourned.
Wilson said this week she hopes the legislature finishes the capital budget much earlier next year with a more open process.
Well, it's always upsetting when it's a closed door deal, and that's absolutely what it was. We weren't called back until a deal was made. You could pretty much tell that when they met at 1 o'clock and within, 5 or 10 minutes, it was done. And I just don't think that's very fair to Alaskans not to be able to take part.
Lawmakers in both chambers heard public testimony on the capital budget before passing separate versions. Anchorage Democratic Representative Les Guerra says the public and the minority also had more than a month to weigh in. And lawmakers were facing a deadline. Governor Bill Walker's administration was concerned construction projects would be delayed if the legislature didn't pass a capital budget by July 31st. Guerra also says lawmakers save money from per diem expenses by negotiating outside of the session.
The two choices were to sit down there griping with each other with people collecting per diem in Juneau for a week or two as you haggled everything out, or to say, look, go home, don't collect per diem. A group of people will try and figure out a proposal, see if it gets enough votes. And that's what happened.
Political scientist Clive Thomas says the extraordinarily late capital budget was a factor in the closed process outside of Juneau. He's formerly with the University of Alaska Southeast.
Most capital budgets are usually dealt with by the end of the session, the first session, the end of the regular session. So I've never known of this process before.
Legislators spent the extended session and earlier special sessions with the operating budget and a bill overhauling oil and gas taxes. Representative Guerra says he'd also like next year's capital and operating budgets to be resolved sooner. But he says some lawmakers hold out in the hope that the other side will cave. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
A family friend and neighbor of the Utah woman who was killed aboard a cruise ship off Alaska's coast last week is raising money for her three daughters. He tells KTOO's Trip Krause that the family had appeared happy and that he's trying to help the children with a GoFundMe campaign.
Dana Nichols' family lived across the street from the Manzanarises in Utah.
His six children, ages 12 to 22, grew up alongside Kenneth and Christy Manzanares' three daughters for a little more than 8 years.
It's tough. We're close with the family, the girls. Their children are like my children. They spent more time at our home than they did their own.
Nichols is a real estate agent and worked with Christy. He calls her a wonderful, beaming ray of sunshine. When he heard she'd been killed aboard a cruise ship in Alaska, he was devastated. He started a GoFundMe campaign for the daughters.
Their children are what is important to us at this point, and they've had their worlds turned upside down, and it's a tragedy.
Christy Manzanares was found dead aboard the Emerald Princess cruise ship last month after what the cruise line called a domestic dispute. Witnesses told investigators that Christy's husband, Kenneth Manzanares, had blood all over his clothes and hands. Kenneth Manzanares is facing a federal murder charge. Nichols isn't sure what the money will specifically go toward, but says it won't fund Kenneth Manzanares' legal defense.
I love Kenny. He's a good guy. But that's not why the GoFundMe page was put together. It is simply for their girls and any needs that may arise for them.
It's more than halfway to its $50,000 goal. Nichols says the whole ordeal is terrible. He remembers the couple as being wonderful friends and neighbors.
I've seen a lot of different reports and just comments from people about Kenny being a monster. Nothing further from the truth. They were both wonderful people. And I don't know what happened, you know.
Another family friend set up a second GoFundMe account to raise money for funeral expenses. It has raised nearly $10,000, almost a third of its goal. In Juneau, I'm Trip J. Krause.
Alcohol appears to be at the center of the shooting death of an off-duty Nunumpachuk Village police officer in Napaskiak. According to court documents, a village public safety officer was called to the scene of a shooting on Sunday morning. When VPSO Greg Larson arrived at the house, a 9-year-old boy came out saying his older brother had shot a man. Inside, Larson found 26-year-old Kyle Wassily, an off-duty village police officer for Nunumpachuk, lying in the entryway with a bullet through his chest and stomach area. Nearby, Larson found 19-year-old Adam Williams, quote, passed out drunk. Court documents indicate the rifle suspected of firing the bullets was found in the kitchen, along with an empty cartridge by the body and empty vodka bottles. Health aides tried to revive Wassily, but were unsuccessful. Williams faces charges of murder in the first degree. He does not have a prior record. After more than 10 years of planning, construction at a training facility for Alaska Police is nearing completion, and project managers say it should open this fall. The Chugiak Eagle River Star reported Sunday the South Central Law Enforcement Tactical Training Center in Birchwood, just north of the Anchorage Bowl, is progressing ahead of schedule. It will have 4 shooting ranges catering to local, state, and federal law enforcement. Director of Maintenance and Operations for Anchorage's Public Works Department, Alan Kowski, says construction is expected to cost about $4.5 million on top of around $2.5 million more spent on the land purchase and design work. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, how Pacific Northwest planners are preparing for a calamity.
There's going to be a lot more heartburn if we have that tsunami, and we've continued to move forward with the status quo.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 40 years of operations in Alaska.
After hearing from more than 40 people in a packed chamber, the Matsu Borough Assembly has indefinitely postponed an ordinance to place a 2% sales tax before borough voters. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
The sales tax proposal before the Borough Assembly on Tuesday came from a request by the Matsu Borough School Board. With continuing uncertainty around state funding and with flat funding from the borough, the district hopes to use a sales tax to boost education funding in the MAT-SU. The assembly ultimately voted 6-1 to postpone the ordinance indefinitely. Tim Walters, president of the MAT-SU Education Association, spoke in favor of a new revenue stream for local schools. He says continuing the status quo will lead to larger and larger class sizes.
This year, we'll see high school classes in the 40s. You'll hear stories of kindergarten classes in the 30s.
While others spoke in favor of the sales tax, the majority of those who addressed the assembly were opposed. Representatives of all three incorporated cities in the borough spoke in opposition to placing a sales tax on the ballot. Wasilla Mayor Burt Cottle says labeling the tax as a measure to fund education doesn't fall in line with what the state requires of area-wide taxes.
Under state constitution, you cannot dedicate taxes. So what you do once you collect the tax money is up to you, and it's up to each assembly. Each year you have an assembly sitting there. This is no different than what the borough does each year with the property taxes.
Many who spoke on Tuesday raised similar points and say that while the current assembly may hold true to putting sales tax money to education, future assemblies would have no legal requirement to do so. Those in opposition to the tax cite multiple concerns, including hurting local businesses and a disproportionate impact on the poor. Many also believe the school district could be doing more to reduce its budget without impacting the classroom. Another issue that came up multiple times at Tuesday's meeting is school performance in Alaska relative to the amounts spent. According to data from the U.S. Census Bureau, Alaska spends the second most on education per pupil in the country at just over $20,000. Mike Alexander says that spending is not translating to better results relative to other states.
We're buying an Escalade, we think, and we're getting a Yugo because our kids are testing horribly.
Alaska is below the national average, both in terms of graduation rate and standardized test performance. Jillian Morrissey, public information officer for the MAT-SU Borough School District, says using statewide performance numbers to describe results in the MAT-SU isn't apples to apples.
When we use those numbers that are statewide, it's taking into account all of these rural villages all over the state of Alaska. So our graduation rate is different than when you look at statewide.
Morrissey is correct. According to the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development, graduation rates in the MAT-SU are higher than the state average. Morrissey says that's not a coincidence.
There has been a really big effort in our core schools to make sure that our graduation rates continue to rise, and we're seeing that trend. And that's happening in the last 5 to 10 years, which is really exciting.
As for high per student spending, Jillian Morrissey says the district is looking at ways to operate more efficiently, including capital improvements and distance learning, but that basic costs are continually rising. While the current sales tax proposal was effectively killed, the conversation concerning other means of education funding is not over. The assembly directed borough manager John Moosey to speak to cities, the school district, and local business leaders to try to hammer out a solution. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
More tourists will come to Alaska next summer on cruise ships. Research by Wells Fargo Securities predicts about 6% growth from this summer's number, which is a little more than 1 million passengers. The company projects growth from 5 to 10% in other markets around the world. The numbers are based on capacity, not tickets booked. Cruise Lines International Association Alaska President John Binkley says they're following the money.
Most of these are publicly traded companies, so they're looking at where they can take these assets, the ships, and move them to the destination where they're able to get the best return on investment for their shareholders. And right now, Alaska is popular, and people want to travel to Alaska, so that allows them to charge a little higher price because there's a high demand.
Binkley says factors include Alaska-based reality TV shows, interest in the Arctic, and strong marketing. He also says many tourists consider the state to be safe and secure.
Some geopolitical problems around the world in some areas cause people to want to go to a domestic location that's exotic, like Alaska, rather than a foreign destination where the perceived safety might be in question.
Binkley expects growth to continue into the 2019 season, though he doesn't have the numbers yet. The Wells Fargo study projects 6% market growth worldwide in 2018, the same as in Alaska. More and larger ships are driving the boom. Australia will have even more capacity, as will Europe, excluding the Mediterranean. The Caribbean and China are expected to see lower growth.
We'll be right back.
100 tons of gravel have restored a remote runway in Yukon Charley River's National Preserve. The Galvin's 700-foot-long airstrip along the Charley River was damaged by a 2012 flood. Preserve spokeswoman Chris Pfister says the landing strip was out of service until NPS personnel teamed up with volunteers from Alaska backcountry hunters and anglers in June to rebuild the severely eroded runway.
There were deep indentations and gaps in the coverage in the strip, so it essentially made it unusable. And they moved a tremendous amount of gravel. It was a huge amount of work.
Pfister says a helicopter with a bucket was used to ferry rock and gravel from the river to the nearby airstrip.
200,000 pounds of gravel was moved, and the rock was loaded by hand into the bucket and then moved a short distance to the strip itself, where then it was spread again by hand.
Pfister says the Galvin's airstrip provides access to the Charley River at a point where water levels are generally high enough for larger boats. She says in the years since the strip was damaged, floaters have had to put in 40 miles upriver at the Three Fingers airstrip.
Really made the river mostly inaccessible to anyone trying to float with something larger than a pack raft.
Pfister says the project, completed over 10 days, has readied the Galvin strip in time for summer and fall float and hunting trips. New Stewyahawk's water is back online. In mid-June, homes in the old HUD section of the village started losing water pressure and losing water altogether. More than 30 homes were affected. KDLG's Avery Lill has an update on the city's water situation.
An engineer from the Alaska Rural Utilities Collaborative arrived on July 5th to repair the well pump. Randall Hastings is the mayor of New Stewyahawk. He says the problem was exacerbated because the sensors that could have alerted the city to a problem in the well house earlier is broken.
The sensor that's on the water tank and in the water plant hasn't been working for over a year, and we've been waiting for a part from ANTHC for it that registers and lets us know how much water's in the tank. And with the system working, then we would have known there was something going on, and we could have probably fixed the problem sooner or prevented us from losing so much pressure that the whole upper village ran out of water.
The sensor remains broken, but the pump is fixed. It took the water tower a while to refill. On July 19th, the city began shutting off water 12 hours a day from 8 in the evening to 8 in the morning.
We had to shut everybody off because those that had water weren't conserving it enough to let the tank fill up.
New Stewyahawk homes were put on boil notice per Department of Environmental Affairs regulations.
Anytime you shut the system down or off and the water pressure drops, you have to put up a boil water notice as a precautionary measure, because if water pressure drops low enough, it would allow any kind of dirt or debris that penetrate a crack or a slight break in the line, and it could allow bacteria or whatever is in the dirt to get into the lines, and as long as the water pressure is up high, then nothing can get inside.
On July 25th, the city announced that it would no longer be shutting off water because the storage tank was 3/4 full. The storage tank is now entirely full and water pressure restored to all homes. However, the city will remain on boil notice until it's able to send a sample of the water to be tested in Dillingham. With the water running again, the city is turning its attention to a perennial problem: customers that aren't paying for their water. About 110 homes there are on city water, and the mayor estimates 20% of them are not paying for the service.
The way our system was set up in the past, long time ago, there's really no way to hardly shut anybody off. The very first houses that were ever built here, the shutoff valves are inside the house, so people aren't going to permit you to go in the house and shut them off.
The city is working to install water main curve valves, an external method for the city to shut off water on every home. That way, when customers stop paying, the city can stop supplying water. Another water problem is completely outside the city's control: the Nooshigak River. It's still running low, and it needs to see more rain upriver before it will be high enough for the first barge to make it to New Stewyahawk this year. One of the key items New Stewyahawk depends on the barge to carry is fuel. Businesses and residents' use of heating fuel is already limited, 50 gallons per month for businesses and 30 gallons per month for homes.
Stew Limited is really dangerously getting low on stove oil, so hopefully the barge will be here soon.
But with a rainy end of July and more rain in the forecast for August, New Stewyahawk Limited anticipates a barge delivery in the next few weeks. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Sooner or later, the Cascadia Fault Zone is going to unleash a monster earthquake and tsunami hitting the Pacific Northwest and affecting parts of Alaska. When that day comes, you hope that coastal schools, fire and police stations, and hospitals are located high enough so that they don't get washed away when you most need them to be there. Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonsi has this update to the tsunami inundation zone in Oregon that is stirring passions you might not expect.
Remember those videos of the massive tsunami hitting the northeast coast of Japan in 2011? The waves of water overtopping seawalls, swallowing buildings, surging higher than anticipated. One thing those images prompted was a re-examination of the tsunami risk along our shores. In Oregon and Washington, the state geology divisions released new tsunami evacuation maps beginning in 2013. More people and property are in harm's way under the new maps, about 30% more along the Oregon coast. And at a series of meetings in Salem, that has proven to be a sticky problem.
Any hazard mapping, as I can attest to from having worked at FEMA and at the state and at the local level, it's always heartburn.
That's Jay Wilson venting at a meeting of Oregon earthquake safety advisors. Structural engineer Jeff Soulage joined Wilson. They're upset at the State Department of Geology for delaying the adoption into statute of the new higher tsunami floodline to regulate vulnerable new construction.
I cannot understand for the life of me why you would wait when you already have these maps. They've been in your hands for 4 years.
There's going to be a lot more heartburn if we have that tsunami. And we've continued to move forward with the status quo.
One way Oregon differs from neighboring Washington and California is that the Oregon legislature long ago made it a rule that certain essential facilities cannot be built inside the tsunami zone. Namely, those would be new hospitals, fire and police stations, schools, colleges, and jails. Existing critical facilities are grandfathered in place, and none of this applies to construction of private businesses and homes. There's a reason the old tsunami line is still in place when it comes to new construction. Strong pushback from coastal legislators, including Republican State Senator Jeff Cruz.
Like a seaside, if you're going to get out, they move the inundation zone line, you got to go miles to get back above it again, right?
The pushback is bipartisan. Democratic State Senator Betsy Johnson says people living along the coast have regulatory fatigue and don't need what she calls holier-than-thou lectures.
I don't think that they need a board in Portland to tell them how to think thoughtfully about tsunamis. The other thing that I am very worried about is that if we allow this culture of casualty to infest our thinking, we drive people away from the coast that the coast needs.
Johnson worries an expanded tsunami zone will upend long-term planning for a new hospital in Astoria. It complicates where to build a new fire station in Gerhardt. Coastal legislators have let the Oregon Department of Geology know in no uncertain terms they would try to strip the agency of authority if it broadens the tsunami regulatory zone. Communications Director Allie Ryan Hansen says the agency's board decided it made sense to pause and consult more with affected communities.
The scientific information about where a tsunami is expected to reach is widely available, but it has not been used to update this regulatory piece. And so our board wants to be responsive.
Hansen says the department in its history has never denied a development application for being inside the tsunami zone. The agency's board tentatively plans to revisit the tsunami line question this December. I'm Tom Bonsi in Portland.
August is the wettest month in Alaska, but just how rainy is it in different parts of the state? We put that question to Brian Brettschneider with our segment Ask a Climatologist. He says the amount of rain in August varies a lot depending on where you are in the state.
We are entering peak wet season in Alaska, and for a large part of the state, August is the highest monthly precipitation total.
Where in the state is it the wettest?
Well, that's an interesting question because it's not even everywhere. So if you ask people in interior Alaska, what's the wettest month of the year? If it's the eastern interior, it would be July. But almost the entire North Slope, the western half of the state, down into much of South Central, August is the wettest month of the year. If you go down into the southeast, it's September and even October in some places. So it's not the same everywhere, but when you throw all those stations into one bucket and you average it all together, you're going to come up with August as the wettest month in Alaska.
Is anywhere the driest?
Kodiak, August is their driest month of the year, but that's a little bit of a special case because their precipitation is very consistent. The difference between their wettest and driest month is not very much. And so it's kind of almost like a fluke that August ends up being the driest month. So it's the driest, but not very dry. But other than Kodiak, most other stations are number 1, 2, and 3 for wettest month in August. But once you get to southeast, you know, it's kind of middle of the pack.
On the ground, how much rain are we talking? Like how many days of rain in August?
Well, that's one of the things that I get asked a lot. People say, well, you know, don't tell me how much rain's going to fall. Tell me how many days I'm going to lose to rain. So say, for an example, in Anchorage, about 15 days, 14 and a half, 15 days in August. So 1 out of every 2 days, you're going to get measurable rain. If you make your way up to Fairbanks, it's about 13 days. And then down in southeast in Juneau, 19 days. So even though it's only for Juneau, August is their fifth wettest month, it still rains a lot. It's a lot of little rains, so 19 days out of the month. So August, lots of little rain events, some big rain events, but pretty wet overall.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Trip Krause and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Avery Lill in Dillingham, Tom Bonsi in Portland, Oregon, and Annie Feit and Johanna Urich in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.